Good morning again. We are in this sermon series called Five Dysfunctions of a Family. We're on the fifth one today. And this has been our series title slide picture. Barry, where did you get this picture?
Google.
Okay. So Google made this picture, but we have some homemade pictures that our children made. And if you were here last week, you saw these, but we're looking at them again. And I will pause on each one for just a little bit so that you can absorb the artwork that our children have done for you. In a little bit, I will show all five of these pictures so that you can look at some similarities and differences. We talked about some of the similarities and differences last week. Can anybody remember some of the similarities and differences from last Sunday? Right. There are smiles in all the pictures. Children in all of them. But there are also some differences. Right? Different numbers of people. What's that? Hair and no hair, right? Pet, no pet. Different colors, right? Okay, yes, some are, right? Are you contrasting the bottom two pictures?
I noticed that Lucas's drawing leaves out his sister. What's up with that?
Okay, Caleb's drawing adds a pet. I don't know if he's trying to tell me something. This morning, I want us to think about what we see and what we don't see in these pictures. Of course, families are different. Different numbers of people, different ratios of generations and so forth. One thing we see in all of these is happiness. These are happy families. That's because we asked the children to draw pictures of happy families. But there's a lot that we don't see that happens in families, right? We know that family isn't always happy and smiley. But family has ups and downs. Family has good moments and bad moments. Family has stuff that we want to see in pictures, and family has stuff that we want to hide out of the pictures. But this morning we have to face the holistic reality of family. In fact, in life, it would be good for us to face this holistic reality of the good and the bad, the part that we want to think about, the part that we want to look about in these cheerful children's drawings, and the parts that we don't teach our children to draw. Well, as I said, this morning we're concluding the series of Five Dysfunctions of a Family. We've talked about how dysfunctional families put family before God, that dysfunctional families are deceptive and divided and envious, and today we're talking about the fact that dysfunctional families are controlled by emotions. We anchor this message in the story in Genesis 37 and 45. And at the end, I'm going to reach a little bit beyond 45. But in Genesis 37, we find that Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and he brought their father a bad report about them. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons. Okay, you already know that trouble is coming, right? Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made a richly ornamented robe for him. This is the coat of many colors you might have heard about. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him. They what? They hated their brother and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." His brother said to him, "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. And then he had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "As you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them." "Very well," he replied, skipping down a few verses, the middle of verse 17. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. "Here comes that dreamer," they said to each other. "Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams." When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And they sat down to eat their meal. And that's kind of weird. "Let's throw our brother in this ditch over here, and now we'll have our meal while our brother screams out for mercy." They looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he's our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He was so upset. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't here. Where can I turn now? What am I going to do?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They took the ornamented robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son." So his father wept for him. In this chapter, hatred controls this family. We saw repeatedly that Joseph's brothers hated him. They heard the dreams, they hated him, and then they hated him more, and then they hated him even more. And we see in verses 18 to 20 that this hatred led to a desire to do something very bad, and a plotting to do that. So they were plotting to kill him. The hatred led to desire, and the hatred led to a dispute. In verses 21 to 22 and verses 26 to 27, the other brothers are arguing about what to do with Joseph. Let's do this. No, let's do this. No, we shouldn't. We should do this. And that all arose from their hatred of this brother. And in this story, hatred led to disloyalty. In verse 28, the brothers throw Joseph into the cistern. They abandon their brother, their own flesh and blood, their family member. You know, family members are supposed to stick together, right? Family members are supposed to support each other through good and bad, thick and thin. But hatred can lead to disloyalty. And in this story, hatred led to deceit. In verses 31 to 35, what do the brothers do? They take Joseph's robe and put an animal's blood on it and take it to their father and make him think that Joseph has died, even though he hasn't. This hatred leads to desire, dispute, disloyalty, and deceit. And this morning, I want to focus in a little bit on conflict, because we see conflict in this story. We see this dispute, and this hatred leads to this dispute or disagreement or conflict. And this is something that we really need to think about as Christians. And if we are fueled by hatred or any other totally uncontrolled emotion, then our conflicts can get really out of hand, and our conflicts can end in results that are disastrous, perhaps even deadly. So it's important for us to think about emotions and conflict. Anytime that I talk about conflict with people, I like to start out with three basic principles, three basic truths that we need to acknowledge before we talk about conflict anymore. And the first one of those is that conflict is inevitable. Joseph and his brothers were going to have conflict, right? If you have siblings, you know that conflict happens. If you have family members, you know conflict happens. If you have neighbors, you know conflict happens. If you're a hermit, maybe not. But how many of us are hermits? The only way to avoid interpersonal conflict with other people, is to just completely stay away from people. And we can't do that. Conflict is inevitable. Second, conflict is neither good nor bad. Now, some of us might have grown up learning that conflict is bad and it's to be avoided at all costs. Some of us might have been raised to embrace conflict. Somebody hits you, hit them back. Right? We're raised with different approaches to conflict, but conflict itself is neither good nor bad, regardless of what we've grown up thinking about it. And third, what is good or bad about conflict is how we deal with it. Whenever conflict happens, it does and it will, whenever conflict happens, what we do in that moment of conflict or in that season of conflict is what's really important and what is good or bad. There are a lot of things that contribute to how we deal with conflict. We deal with conflict in different ways. I'm sure that Israel's sons dealt with conflict in different ways. In fact, we see that in the story. You know, Reuben dealt with the conflict very differently from how some of the other brothers did. And we deal with conflict differently. And some things that contribute to how we deal with conflict are our educations. And by education, I do mean that plural, right? Because I have different educations. I have been educated by my parents. I have been educated by my friends. I've been educated by my wife and my son. I've been educated by some teachers. We learn in different ways, you know, and what I watch and what I read and what I listen to, it's all educating me. And how we deal with conflict is shaped by what we have learned from various people and things, our educations. Expectations contribute to how we deal with conflict. Whenever I'm in a conflict, what I expect to get out of that or what I expect another person to get out of that determines how I deal with that conflict. Right? If you and I are in a little disagreement about something and I don't really care about it, I have no expectation at all, I'm just like, whatever, then I'm probably not going to be real intensely involved in trying to settle that conflict. I'm just going to kind of try to ignore it, right? But if I have a really big expectation, you know, I want something really great to happen out of this conflict, then I'm going to work harder, and I'll use a different approach to that conflict. Our emotions contribute to how we deal with conflict. If I am a hateful person, I'm probably not going to be very good at collaboration. Right? If I don't care about other people at all, then I'm probably always going to take an approach that is for my benefit and not other people's benefits. And when these emotions are uncontrolled, then I just go with whatever conflict style happens to be natural for me. And if I'm hateful, that's probably going to be a my way or the highway kind of approach. But maybe I'm dealing with some other kind of uncontrolled emotion. A couple of people with the last names of Thomas and Kilman several years ago came up with this model. Well, this is my version of the model. They came up with a model of five conflict styles. And as you see on the left, the left vertical line there symbolizes concern for self. The bottom line symbolizes concern for others. And there are some ways of dealing with conflict that have high concern for self, and there are some ways that have high concern for others. If you're in a conflict and you don't really care what you get out of it, and you really don't care what somebody else gets out of it, you don't really care about the conflict at all or anybody involved in the conflict, then you're probably going to just avoid the conflict. But let's say that you really you don't have a lot of investment in the conflict, and you don't really care what you want, but you really want the other person to get what they want, and you're going to accommodate and let the other person have what that person needs or wants. But let's say you have a really high concern for yourself and what you get out of this conflict. You want things to be the way you want them to be, and you're not really interested in the other people involved. You know how things are supposed to be, and that's that. Then you're going to have this competition style of conflict where it's my way or the highway. It's a win-lose situation. One person is going to win, the other person is going to lose. Compromise is kind of in the middle. That's where you get some of what you want and I get some of what I want. I don't get 100%, you don't get 100%, but it's more of a 50-50 deal. But collaboration is where everybody wins, everybody gets 100% of what they want or need. Now, that's not always possible. The resources have to be in place. Everybody involved has to be willing to work for this. And even then, it might or might not happen. Compromise is usually more realistic, but collaboration is ideal. Most of the time. But there are some conflict situations where competition, the authoritarian approach, might be the best way. You know? If my son is running out into the street, I'm not going to take time to collaborate. Right? So none of these styles, no style that you see here is bad or good in itself, but these are tools to use depending on the situation. Now, Joseph's brothers were controlled by hatred and they had one way of dealing with this: get rid of Joseph. Right? Now, there were some different options for getting rid of Joseph, but they had to get rid of Joseph. This morning, I want to share with you a few lessons from all of this that can help your families, I hope. 5 suggestions for healthy conflict in families. First, acknowledge all the members' needs. Now, that's hard if we're dealing with uncontrolled emotions. If I'm all full of hatred or animosity or some other kind of emotion that can be unhealthy, and I'm not dealing with that emotion, then I am likely to ignore some people's needs. If I'm full of hatred, I might ignore other people's needs and just focus on my own. But maybe I'm dealing with some other emotion that is controlling me, and I end up focusing on other people's needs but ignoring my own. So we need to acknowledge all members' needs. Second, accept all members' perspectives. How you view a situation is different from how someone else views that situation. And if there's a conflict, then I can't just assume, let's say Barry and I have some kind of disagreement, I can't just assume that he has the same perspective that I have on the situation. Address all members' emotions. If there's hatred, get it out on the table and deal with it. Right? But if there's some other unhealthy emotion that is controlling you or some other people involved in the conflict, you have to get that out and deal with it. If you don't deal with it, it just continues. So address the members' emotions. Attempt a range of approaches. Don't just narrow in on one. If one thing doesn't work well, try another style, try another tool, another method. Don't assume that everything is a nail and needs a hammer, right? And appreciate God's work. So we have these 5 different ways of dealing with conflict. We know some things that contribute to how we deal with conflict, and of course there are other things. And so we have this natural, this default way of dealing with conflict. This is what feels natural to us, but now we know that there are other ways of dealing with conflict too, and different approaches are helpful in different situations. But in all of this, we need to appreciate God's work. I hope that we will try to deal with family conflicts and other conflicts in good, healthy, responsible, effective ways But we need to pray for God to work through all our efforts. Because, you know, no matter how hard we try, sometimes we are controlled by emotions. No matter how hard we try, we might not always act with other people's concerns before our own. We might not have that other-centeredness that we saw in Philippians 2 last week. But we let all these things control us and make us lose our focus, and we don't deal with conflict the way we know we should. And it's amazing to me, no matter how much I learn about dealing with conflict, when I myself, I'm in the conflict situation, it's hard for me to remember stuff, you know, these different ways of dealing with conflict and things I need to think about and, you know, what's going on under the surface of the conflict issue and all this stuff. But I have to pray for God to work through all of my inadequacies and incompetencies and weaknesses. And God does work through messed up family conflict. Thank goodness. Look at Genesis chapter 45. Verses 5 through 9. I'll skip up a little bit. Let's start with verse 1. Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers, and he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. I mean, they threw him in a ditch, and then they sold him into slavery, and they made his father think he was dead. And now all of a sudden, there they are. And he is in charge. And he has the power to do anything he wants with their lives. And Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, imagine the terror. Okay, coming close. Don't know what he's going to do. When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and don't be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to prepare for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, Lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay.'" So who was responsible for Joseph getting to Egypt? God. Yeah. Now his brothers played a part, right? They did some really bad stuff, and bad things happened as a result. But God used the bad for good. God works through messed up family conflict. Check out Genesis chapter 50. In verse 20, Israel has died, and so Joseph's brothers are terrified because they're thinking, now that dad is gone, Joseph will enact his revenge. right? Our father isn't here to talk him down anymore. His anger is going to come out. But Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Verse 20. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. You intended it for harm, but God is using it for good, not just for me, but for tons of people. God can do amazing things through messed up family conflict. Does that mean that God fixes every family conflict? No. But God can work through messed up family conflict. Does it mean that we don't need to try to deal with conflict in good, healthy, Christ-like ways? No. But God can work through messed up family conflict. Praise God for that. Maybe something in this message has touched you, and you want somebody to pray with you, pray for you. Maybe you want to talk about how you can become a Jesus follower or be more faithful as a follower of Jesus. Maybe interpersonal conflict is on your mind right now and you're thinking about the many ways that you have messed up in trying to treat people with dignity and respect. Maybe you've messed up in living out the love and peace that God calls us to through Jesus. Well, a couple of us will be in the back of this room as we sing this next song. We invite you to come. Let us know how we can pray for you and with you. Let us know what you need to talk about. Well, let's praise God, because God works through messed up family conflict.